For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, all right then. What we want to talk about tonight isn't so much the plot line of the story, because we talked some about that last week. And we talked about conspiracy theories, and we talked about this alternative rendering of Christianity, this thing that is called Gnosticism, which really did exist in the ancient world, a fusion, really, of pagan mysticism and pseudo-Greek philosophy. And it's kind of a way of thinking that's desperately in search of a narrative. And so these people kind of click into the Christian text and the Christian message and interpret it in the light of their kind of mystical outlook. And the argument has been put forth not just in the Da Vinci Code, but by a fairly wide range of people, including some fairly serious-minded scholars, that Gnosticism is a legitimate sort of alternative form of Christianity, and that it got more or less elbowed out of the way, oppressed really, driven underground by the political maneuvering of the so-called Orthodox Church, the people who believed in the Bible as the standard for what Christianity really is. And that has raised a lot of questions, I think, in our culture. And what I want to do here this evening is just for a couple of minutes review what seems to be the irreconcilable claims of Gnostic Christianity with biblical Christianity, and then raise some of the critical questions about how we might arrive at some conclusions about this. Last time we were talking about basically what is the worldview, what is the thought world, what are the assumptions that drive and inform and define what Gnosticism is in relation to biblical Christianity. We pointed out that for the Gnostics, Jesus was really only a man. He was, I suppose, a privileged man in some senses, in the sense that he discovered his inner divinity and in that way kind of separated himself from everybody else. But at the end of the day, Jesus of Nazareth was simply a man. And we can contrast that in pretty sharp terms with the New Testament teaching of Jesus, that he is God incarnate. In John chapter 1, John retells, in essence, the creation story and identifying Jesus as the instrument through which God created the heavens and the earth, that he is fully God and yet becomes fully human. And this is not just some sort of a New Testament teaching even in itself. It's also taught in the Old Testament that when God's Messiah would come, according to Isaiah, the prophet, chapter 9 and verse 6, that he would be God incarnate, that he would be, he's described as the Almighty Father, God. And so there is an expectation in the Jewish scriptures that God would come into human history in a personal way through the agency of his Messiah. The New Testament's claim is that that did happen, and it happened through the person of Jesus Christ. The Gnostics teach that there was no physical resurrection. That for them, you know, the flesh is just the flesh. It doesn't matter what happened after Jesus died. That's pretty much the end of the story as far as they're concerned for who Jesus is. But for the biblical writers, New Testament writers, the physical resurrection of Jesus from the dead is the foundational teaching of Christianity. And we talked about this last time from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where Paul says, if there is no physical resurrection of Christ from the dead, then there can be no assurance that his payment for human sin on the cross was satisfactory to God. That it's only through God resuscitating his life, giving him victory over death, that we can have any assurance ourselves that what he did on the cross for us really amounts to anything. That's God's proof that that is, in fact, the true message. For the Gnostic thinkers, really, it's all about enlightenment and getting a secret message and having a mystical experience that enables one to kind of connect in a conscious way with our own inner divinity. And in this way, boy, I don't know if you're familiar with some of the recent writings of people in our culture, New Age type of thinking. It's really Gnosticism in a new kind of cloth. But the biblical view is not that human beings are ignorant of their inner divinity. That's not really the problem with humankind. The problem with humankind is that we are alienated from God on the basis of our sin, our own choices to rebel against His authority, to rebel against His leadership in our lives. And there's a barrier that exists now between ourselves and Him. And that the real issue is, will we seek His forgiveness on the basis of the cross, that His death would be our death, so that God's justice is satisfied? And in this way, then, having our sins paid for by Christ, then there's no longer that barrier there. And it's possible for us just to say, God, I realize that the death of Christ was the death that I deserve, that He died for me. And I'm prepared to accept His death as a substitute for mine, and I seek Your forgiveness. I ask that You forgive me. And the Bible says that when we respond to God in this way, He does forgive, and therefore we are reconciled with God. We've got something permanent and real going on with God in our lives that will last us for the rest of our lives and throughout eternity. And so you can see some fairly important differences in these two versions of Christianity. Now, the questions we want to get into here tonight. How would we know which version had it right? And why are we bothering to talk about this? Seems to me that both of those questions are important, and I want to spend a lot of time this evening in relation to the first question. How do we know which version is right? Is it the canonical New Testament? Is that what the real Christian message is? Or is it this other view? Is it this Gnostic view? And I think that whether we're prepared to become Christians or not, whether even the Christian message to us is plausible or not, I think it is at least important that we come to an understanding of what is that message. And therefore, it's important for us to be able to distinguish between the Gnostic and biblical views of Christianity and which is most plausibly the authentic message, knowing that the two are fundamentally irreconcilable. Does that make sense to you? Whether you accept it or not, at least let's make sure that we get the story straight. And so that's what we want to do tonight. How would we think about this? Okay, how would we know how to determine which is the real story and what isn't? What would we appeal to? What would be the standard? How would we even begin to start thinking this thing through? What do you think? What would be important for you to have clear in your mind in order to distinguish between these two views of Christianity? So there might be some historical evidence that could shed some light on which version of, that we're talking about here is true. It's a good point. What else? Okay, so these are, in some ways, these are reports by people at least writing in the name of Jesus' disciples. And so it would matter when these things were written, because if they're written, say, 100 years after the fact or 200 years after the fact, well, it just wouldn't be all that reliable, would it? I mean, there's a lot of suspicion about its reliability, to be sure. Whereas if these documents are written, really close to the life of Christ Himself, then it seems like it might be a little bit more plausible that way. Okay, that's a good thought. What else? Okay, so we're wanting to probe into then, what do other people say about Christianity who are not maybe themselves Christians? And what light would that shed then on which verdict, which story renders the right verdict? Good. Anything else before we move on? Okay. So in as much as Christianity is making claims to the kind of the totality of human experience, we might look at the content of what's being said and be able to draw some conclusions about whether or not that really rings true in our experience or not. Okay, so for instance, how many here are Scotch in their genetic background? Okay, so you know about the stories in the Scottish countryside of these weird markings in the fields, right? Familiar with that? And some people report that they saw UFOs and that these were landing maps or whatever, landing pads for UFOs. And then other people were saying, no, it's just a bunch of drunk Scotsmen. Okay, now, John raises the question, you know, which one are you going to believe? You know, there's testimony that goes both ways, but what is it, which view kind of rings true in our experience? You know, in sort of a broad sense, I mean, to accept the UFO story is to accept, you know, a pretty big deal, isn't it? That there are these conspiratorial aliens that are out there that just come at clandestine locations, could only be found at night by a few people in remote places. And what I think I hear being said is that it's just not plausible. It doesn't fit in with the rest of the way that we really think that we ought to view the world around us. I think that's good. Well, let me break it down here a little bit and think about it from the standpoint of kind of the tools of the historian. How do historians look at ancient texts? How do historians try to fit pieces together? How do historians come to conclusions about whether or not something that is purported to have happened really took place? Okay, and a lot of what we want to talk about tonight is really building on the insights that many of you have shared already. The first thing we want to look at is the difference in the message between the Gnostic and the biblical traditions, specifically in terms of the fact that Gnostic writings universally, almost by definition really, introduced readers to secret knowledge or secret messages. And so the beginning of one of the most popular of the Gnostic Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, says, these are the secret words which the living Jesus spoke. And so it goes on and has a whole catalog of sayings from Jesus that are in no way like a historical narrative, like the four Gospels show Jesus, you know, who his stepfather was, who his mother was, where he lived, and the people that he interacted with, and there's a lot of geography and things like that. It kind of, we can locate Jesus in space and in time. The Gnostic Gospels aren't this way. It's all about secret knowledge that doesn't really have anything to do with the physical world at all. And so when Thomas says in the cryptic gospel that what this gospel discloses is the secret words of the living Jesus, it might be appropriate for us to ask the question, how do we know that? How do we know that this text contains these secret teachings that Jesus kind of whispered in a few of his disciples' ears outside of the earshot of anyone else? Beyond the fact that the text says so. How would we know? What do you think? How would we know? If it's a secret message told only to one, in this case Thomas, in other Gnostic Gospels it's told only to one, like Judas or someone like that, how would we know that the message contained in the gospel is this real secret message that Jesus taught? Other than the fact that the text says so. You can't. Well, yeah, that is sort of a galling thought, isn't it? How would we know? And you arrive at the conclusion that you can't. I think a lot of people would do that as well. Why do we believe what it says if we can't point to anything to underpin it, to ground it in anything real, anything that we do know about? And this is, I think, really a fundamental problem that historians have had all along with this collection of Gnostic Gospels, which is that since they don't make any claim to history, then they aren't really informative. They don't provide for us any reason to believe that what they have to say is true, other than the fact that perhaps, well, that sounds like a pretty good belief to me. I like what I'm hearing here. Sign me up. But outside of that, we're really left with nothing that at least appeals to our curiosity or to our intellectual faculties. And here, I think, is a fundamental difference between what we see in the Gnostic Gospels and what we read in the New Testament and the four Gospels that were collected for that purpose. Namely, that in the biblical texts, we find Jesus as a real person living in real history. And so when, for instance, Luke records his gospel, look at the difference between this and the beginning of the Gospel of Thomas. The disclosing of secret wisdom on the one hand. On the other hand, Luke says, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word have handed them down to us, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. Okay, let's just think about this statement. This is Luke's introduction to his gospel. In what way does this differ from Thomas's methodology as a writer? Thomas is disclosing the truth about Jesus one way, Luke in a very different way. How is Luke's different? Any thoughts? Okay, not just one, but several people have attempted the same sort of thing that he's doing, which is interesting, isn't it? There's something to compare what Luke is writing to in that sense. It's you know, when you go to the scene of an accident, it's good to have more than one witness. You want to have several witnesses and then corroborate their stories on the basis of those multiple testimonies. That's a very good point. What else? He's investigated these things carefully, he says. So he's done some research. Good. What else? Okay, these are public events that are recorded by people who actually saw them. So that's important. What else? Yes, the chronological element here. So there is a concern on Luke's part for real history and the real sequence of events. How different this is. Excellent point. You bring out the legal defense part and you root that in Acts. Yes? Exactly. There is no secret story, no secret message. It's all public. It's all out in the open. And events recorded in this gospel form the base then of a collective witness to these events. Good. Craig brought up a minute ago that it's a legal defense. I think that's true. A lot of people have made this point. His reference to this person whom he calls most excellent Theophilus. You see that in the third line from the bottom. Theophilus is a Greek name. The title most excellent is a standard title or term used for a Roman official. And it has been long argued, and I think successfully argued, that Luke, the Gospel of Luke, and then the book of Acts, which Luke also wrote, which is a chronicle, a history of the early church, are essentially legal briefs written on Paul's behalf because, as the end of Acts shows, he is in the city of Rome. He's about to appeal his case before the emperor himself. And it's very clear in reading Luke and Acts that Jesus is innocent of any sort of crime against the state by Roman legal standards, that Paul in the book of Acts also is innocent of any crime according to Roman legal standards, and it cites several verdicts rendered by Roman officials to this effect. And what it's very clear, the analytical nature of Luke's gospel, which is really evident in all of the gospels, is that they are concerned for history, they're concerned for accuracy, they're concerned with chronology, and they want us to understand that this isn't hearsay, that this isn't some sort of a myth, that this is something that is fundamentally rooted in confirmable historical fact. It's a very, very different proposition. Now, what's important from the standpoint of the historian, as they look at a document like Luke's, is that it fits what they call the criterion of falsification. In other words, it makes claims that can be assessed and analyzed on the basis of evidence, and if the evidence contradicts the claim that is made in the gospel, then it is possible for us, then, and then maybe obligatory for us, to reject the truth of the gospel itself. So, for instance, if Jesus was not the son of Mary, and that fact came to light, then it would render false what Luke records about the relationship between Jesus and his mother, right? If the Gospel of Luke says that Jesus was executed under Pontius Pilate, and then historians go to find out, gosh, you know, Pontius Pilate wasn't even in Judea until, you know, 400 AD, we've got a problem, right? And it falsifies the claim that Luke makes. The reason why this is important, then, is because we can analyze Luke's text. We can check it against the history of the ancient world as we continue to assemble that through archaeology, through the writings of the ancient Roman Empire, of Jewish sources and others, and we can check Luke's gospel against the facts of the matter. When Luke makes an assertion, most of the time we can go back and we can check that against other sources outside the Bible. One person who did this was an archaeologist by the name of Sir William Ramsay. This is about 100 years ago now. He spent his 30-year career studying Luke and Acts with the very express intention of demonstrating that Luke's account of history was false. He believed that that was the case, and so he went out to establish once and for all that we can just put the New Testament in the rubbish can with every other myth and every other superstition and every other weird kind of religious doctrine or idea that's out there. However, after his careful search into Luke's history, Ramsay says, and I'm citing him here, Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, and he spent a lot of years investigating that whole point. He says he is possessed of the true historic sense. In short, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians because of his concern for detail, because of the accuracy with which he writes. And I think that that's a very important piece of this. When we're reading the biblical gospels, we're not reading some sort of a dream or a vision or a religious conviction. We're reading something that's history. Peter himself makes exactly this point in 2 Peter. We're studying 1 Peter on Sunday night, but he wrote two letters. And 2 Peter says in chapter 1, verse 16, Peter says, "We did not follow cleverly devised tales," literally myth, "when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." And that is the character and the flavor of the whole of the New Testament, that it's rooted in confirmable historical fact. It's very important that we keep that in view. We also find in the Gospels of the New Testament something fundamentally out of character with the Gnostic writings, which is the deep connection in the Gospels with the Old Testament. And so when you read through the Gospels, you'll see that in almost every chapter, something out of the Old Testament is being cited. That Jesus, in a unique and confirmable way, is fulfilling the imagery of the Messiah as it's laid out hundreds of years beforehand in the Old Testament. And none of this, of course, applies to the Gnostic writings, which has led most scholars to conclude that the Gnostic writings were not written by Jewish people, that they were written by Gentiles who really did not have deep knowledge or significant knowledge of the Old Testament at all. Why is this important from the standpoint of the historian to see the deep connection between the Old Testament and the Gospels? Who's got a thought on that? An opinion? Why would it matter? Think about who were the first Christians. Who were they? They were Jewish. Right. What would be persuasive to a Jewish audience, someone who's interacting with the claims about Christianity? The first thing they would think would be, is this consistent with what we read about the Messiah in the Old Testament? And so that's why the gospel writers are at pains to show that connection there. Okay, and so it lends some authenticity to it in that way. If there are things attributed to Jesus that are fundamentally out of character with the biblical view of Messiah in the Old Testament, that also would be reason to reject Jesus' claims to being the Messiah. Third point here about the historical rootedness of the Gospels and of the New Testament. that this is factual accounts for the costly testimony that these writers paid. Look, if what they're writing about is a myth, it's a real cool story, it's something they'd like to believe, but really didn't happen, like they said it really did happen, then what it makes nonsense out of the fact that they paid for the testimony that they wrote with their own lives. Most of these people were executed for the confession of their belief, for their eyewitness accounts. See, people believe lies all the time. People are deceived easily, I think, aren't they? Like so many of the German people in the mid-1930s and 1940s were really misled about who is this Hitler guy and the Third Reich and all that kind of stuff. But how, and they went to their death in support of this myth. But how many people would die for what they knew to be a lie? See, it was the people on the inside in the SS and in the higher echelons of Hitler's government that wouldn't stand there and fight till the bitter end. They ran like hell, didn't they? To Brazil and Argentina and places like that. They wouldn't stand by their story, no way. But these people did stand by their story at enormous cost to themselves. Further, it helps us to understand what it was that catalyzed a movement that went from a small group of maybe 70 people to a movement at the end of the first century of over a million people who are responding to the evidence, who are responding to what they see in the Christian message. See, there's a mark of authenticity about this. It gets back to the point that you made a little while ago. It's if you really know something to be true, and that truth is that profound, you're willing to live consistently with it, and you can live consistently with it. And in profound contrast to Gnostics of the second and third centuries, who in the face of persecution from the state almost universally went ahead and denied central Christian truths, offered up their sacrifices to the state and so forth, while the biblical Christians were going to be fed by the lions in the Colosseum. It's just very different in character, isn't it? Let's look at a second area. On the one hand, the Gnostics are not historically rooted in any way. It's just kind of a stream of sayings, of expressions, of aphorisms. On the other hand, the biblical gospels are expressly rooted in history. Secondly, let's get to the question of dating and the authorship of the text, because this is important too. I mean, after all, Thomas was a disciple of Jesus. Did he write the Gospel of Thomas? Judas, he was one of the 12. Maybe he wrote the Gospel of Judas. Are these plausible claims? This is Jesus' death in 33. The early construction of the New Testament. With the exception of the Gospel of John, the whole New Testament is completed within 40 years of the death of Christ. In comparison to the Gnostic texts, the most charitable dates of which go back to 120, 150 AD. Now, think about this, folks, for just a minute. Is it possible that Thomas, the disciple of Jesus, wrote the Gospel of Thomas in 150 AD? How old would that make him? At least 150. That's a problem for this whole outlook. And yet, at the same time, the biblical texts are being written within a decade, within two and three and four decades of these events actually having taken place. There were people around who could say, man, it didn't go down like that. I was there. And they can confirm these things, but that's not the case with these Gospels. You know, I was thinking about that. How many people have seen the big deal they have on the Gospel of Judas now on the History Channel and stuff like that? You seen that? Pretty wild stuff. How do they introduce the reader, the watcher to that, to the Gospel of Judas? This is going to shake the very foundations of the Christian message, this alternative reading of the Gospel of Judas. The story goes like this, that on the last night of Jesus' life, at the Last Supper, Jesus takes Judas aside and says, basically, the rest of the 11 are my pseudo-disciples, but you're my real disciple. It's my will that you turn me into the authorities and have me killed, and you will receive true enlightenment. Okay? Now, what's interesting about this is that Judas somehow that night sat down, wrote the entire Gospel of Judas, and then went out the same night and hung himself. And that somehow he left it with somebody who he could trust to carry this tradition on. It's most implausible. And that's why historians do not take seriously these Gnostic texts as being genuinely apostolic in their origin, written by the apostles. By all accounts, the Gnostic Gospels are attributed to disciples that could not have written them. The most plausible case would be Thomas, that's 2nd century. And there is a legacy. Here's a big word for you. Get out your Scrabble board. Throw some letters out on the table. There's a legacy of what's called pseudepigraphy, which is called pious fraud. So, for instance, in Jewish writing, we know from about 200 BC, books were written like the Assumption of Enoch. Enoch is a fairly obscure character. Not fairly obscure. He's almost completely obscure character. In Genesis 4, something like that. And a whole mystical tradition grew up by some people around Enoch, and somebody wrote the Assumption of Enoch in more or less Enoch's experience at 200 BC. My suggestion, not likely to be Enoch. And of course, no one took it historically either. It was just pious fraud. People would write things in the name of famous people because it gives a specious kind of authority to their thoughts and to their reflections. In many ways, this is exactly what we're reading when we're reading Gnostic Gospels. They could not have been authentically written by these apostles. The external evidence for apostolic authorship of the New Testament is very different, as that graphic, I think, indicates. Here's just some basic facts for us to think about here. That three letters that were written from AD 96 to AD 100, okay, so that makes it about 65 to 70 years after Christ's death and resurrection. The complete New Testament has been written at this time. We have three letters that contain all four Gospels, seven specific letters of the New Testament, one from Clement of Rome, a church leader in Rome, to the city of Corinth, written at about 96 AD, a document called the Didache, which is a collection of what will later become the New Testament texts, and the letter of Barnabas that cites eight of the New Testament letters. And what am I saying here? What I'm saying is that history outside the New Testament is able to demonstrate for us the plausibility, the likelihood, in fact, that when Peter says, no, I wasn't just following a myth, I was an eyewitness, and that he writes what his testimony is, that's very plausible indeed. Because these texts of the New Testament are known to have been written within the lifetime of the disciples. Of that, there can be no question. Very important. By 115, 85% of the New Testament is cited by leaders in one church writing letters to leaders in another church, all identifying New Testament documents as authoritative because they're written by an apostle. This is, again, from the historical point of view, this is a very important piece of information. This enables us to very plausibly argue that these were, in fact, eyewitness accounts, that they were recorded by the people that they are ascribed to and so forth. Very important. Let's look at the third area here and then just draw some conclusions. What makes the Da Vinci Code such a blast is the conspiracy part of it, right? Everyone loves a conspiracy theory. How many went and saw Oliver Stone's JFK? What a great theory, you know. And he was persuasive, too. Though, factually, completely wrong. Okay? Very interesting. But we love that kind of stuff. Who shot JR? The issue is that there was a conspiracy to silence alternative Christianities by the oppressive orthodoxy of the early church. That's fundamental to the argument of Da Vinci Code. It's fundamental to the advocates of the Gnostic Gospels today. That the big, bad, tough, powerful elite within the church suppressed this persecuted and unfortunate group of people. So Dan Brown says, this is citing the Da Vinci Code, Constantine, 4th century, 325 AD, Constantine, he says, the Roman emperor upgraded Jesus' status almost 4 centuries after Jesus' death. Thousands of documents, he says, already existed chronicling Jesus' life as merely a mortal man. Constantine commissioned and financed a new Bible which omitted these Gospels that spoke of Christ's human traits and embellished those Gospels that made him godlike. Well, the idea that he embellished Gospels to make Jesus more godlike, is that plausible based upon what we've already been thinking here? Is that a plausible assertion? How could it be if we've already got the majority content of the New Testament written in the form of letters from one Christian to another that has exactly the same New Testament that you and I read today? It's not possible that Constantine embellished the story of Jesus to make him someone other than what the early records said that he wasn't. Not possible at all, but this is something that's suggested, that Constantine commissioned and financed a new Bible. What historical evidence is there for that? None. But it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah. Conspiracy at the Council of Nicaea in 325. It's important to note that there was nothing about what counts as the Bible and what doesn't count as the Bible in the Council of Nicaea. It was a council to describe the nature of church authority and what doctrines of Christianity were heretical and what were not, because some were teaching that Jesus is not fully divine or not fully human and weird stuff like that. And that's what this council established. It had nothing to do with what constitutes the Bible. And in fact, there is a canon, an accepted book of authoritative scriptures, not at 325, but at 170 AD, called the Moratorian Canon or Fragment. 170, it's a hard date, no one disputes it. And in this canon, this collection of New Testament books, and they're all there, what they establish is that the reason why books are chosen to be included in what will become the New Testament is because they are known to be written by apostles. Not because they sound good or whatever, but we can trace the authorship back, we know that. There were disputed books talked about at this point in Christian history. Disputed books from across the empire. And these disputed books, like the New Testament book of James, the New Testament book of 1 Peter, the New Testament book of Hebrews, had the burden of proof to establish their credibility as really being written by the apostles. So they were very rigorous about this, not just in terms of Gnostic Gospels or whatever, but in terms of what later becomes the New Testament. How do you know that Peter wrote 1 Peter? How do you know Peter wrote 2 Peter? And the churches to whom those letters were written had to be able to present a plausible case for why that was. And if they were able to do that, it was included in the canon. So the official canon formed to collect books known to be authored by apostles and not for the purpose of excluding heretical books. What does that mean? What it means is that by 170, Gnostic Gospels, for the most part, weren't even written. They weren't on the table to be discussed. The canon was not created in some political back room with a bunch of smoke and mirrors and cigars and late night and bottles of vodka and things like that. The canon was not created in any kind of political environment at all. Canon, what makes the New Testament, comes together because people from all over the empire recognize the apostolic authority of the books that are within them. And so they recognize these texts and begin to share them with other churches. That was the point of it. Why do I know that I can lend this letter from Paul that he wrote to me in Ephesus to you, a church in North Africa? Okay, and that's the purpose of these establishing these canons, is so that it basically says, we all agree this is what God wrote through this apostle, and so they could send it out in that way. Bruce Metzger, Princeton University historian, wrote in his book, New Testament, Its Background, Growth, and Content, something that I think kind of summarizes the data, the argument. He says, what is remarkable is that a high degree of unanimity concerning the greater part of the New Testament canon was attained within the first two centuries among the very diverse, scattered congregations, not only in the Mediterranean world, okay, right around the Mediterranean basin, but also over an area extending from Britain all the way to Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq and Iran. And he's saying, to be able to pull that off, letters that have come to be argued and established as genuinely apostolic, that are accepted over that incredible range from between 110 A.D. to about 200 A.D. is just phenomenal by historical terms. I think that's a good way to summarize this historical data. So what have we said? We've said that, okay, we've got competing versions of Christianity. And without agreeing about what's true and what's not, let's at least ask what's plausible and what isn't, based upon the claims made. The ahistorical, non-historical, visionary nature of Gnostic literature that cannot be confirmed or denied in any way based upon historical fact, versus a falsifiable New Testament that chronicles the life of Christ, that makes factual statements that can be either confirmed or denied. That's a big deal. The plausibility that the New Testament authors are, in fact, Jesus' disciples seems very clear on the basis of the evidence outside the New Testament itself that, yes, they could have indeed written these texts, and that the fact that they were willing to argue their case before the Roman courts, that they were willing to go to their death in upholding the testimony that these things were really true, that they really saw them, is persuasive. And then finally, that there is no ancient conspiracy to suppress Gnostic texts that simply did not exist at the time when the New Testament was acknowledged. Not possible. So the whole framework of the Da Vinci Code, the whole framework of the current kind of craze about Gnostic Christianity and stuff like that is really effective because it sells books and because it makes television interesting, and beyond that, there's just very little historical argument that could be made in this way. I just feel like it's very important to put that out, and in a minute I'll give you a bibliography of things you can read on your own to kind of get up to speed if this is interesting to you. Let's just very briefly close with the question, who cares? Okay, so maybe you're right. Who cares? So what? Well, I think we have reason to care here in this environment, because think about what's at stake. What is at stake in the Christian message? Has God spoken? That's a big question. Has God revealed himself uniquely to humanity? That's a big question. What's life about? What's wrong with humanity? How can we get that fixed? What does it mean for us to be right with God? Those are not esoteric and unimportant questions. Those are questions at the very heart of what does it mean to be a human being. There's a lot at stake. Has God spoken? And how would you plausibly know if he had? The argument of the New Testament is that we can know because God has revealed himself uniquely in the person of Jesus, in public, in history, that the record that we have of his life is confirmable to the facts of history, that it fulfills uniquely and powerfully the Old Testament predictions about the Messiah who would come. God has spoken. That's a big deal. And it also, I think, helps us to to come to terms a little bit with the idea of what is faith. What is faith? You know, and I think that we have this idea that faith is what I choose to believe because it's comforting for me. Faith is what I want to believe because it gets me through the day. And what I believe in faith and what I know with my mind are just in two completely different worlds altogether. That's the way our world thinks. That's the way our culture thinks about matters of faith. And I would just have you reflect on the possibility that there's something really wrong with that view of faith. That faith at the exclusion of our intellectual faculties, how can that be a satisfying faith? How can that really respond to the exigencies of life, the difficult things that we face? If I just sort of, oh God, I really believe that somehow my faith is going to get me through, but my faith has no substance that corresponds to the way things really are, it's not going to do me much good. I can really respect people who believe that the world does not exist. It's just an illusion. Okay. But how does that then help you deal with your child's illness? With your own death? With the barbarities of human history that cry out for a solution? It's just not very satisfying to land on the idea that the whole thing's a dream anyway. And yet hundreds of millions of people in our world believe just exactly that. It's not satisfying. Biblical faith is very different. Biblical faith means responding to God, what He has disclosed to us, what it's possible for us to know about Him, with the whole of our being, with the totality of who we are. It means to respond to Him relationally as a person, to trust Him. It means on a moral level that we're prepared to respond to His calling on our life and subordinate our will and our life's purpose to Him. And it means at the end of the day what Jesus meant when He said to love the Lord your God with your whole mind as well. The Bible does not know a separation of faith from rationality. That these two things work together, they weave together. Because we are whole beings, and to interact with a rational God means that we have to engage our minds. Christians need to be thinkers. We have to be able to understand these things. We have to be able to interact with God as a rational being. I think at the end of the day, the reason why this is an important conversation is because whatever it is that brought you here tonight, and maybe it was the arm twisting of a friend or whatever it was, I have no idea. The fact of the matter is that God is pursuing you. That who God is, what God is about, is so important that He is prepared to come into human history, to reveal Himself to humanity. He is pursuing you. And you can know God. And somewhere deep within your own hearts, there is a sense, I think, that is true for all of us, that, you know, there really is a God. My life's not an accident. This whole thing's not just some big biological joke. But there really is a God. And the Bible says, yes, that's right, and He is pursuing you, and you can know Him. And just by opening up your heart to Him, saying, God, make your reality clear to me in a personal way. Help me digest with my mind the propositions that are out on the table. Jesus says that when we seek Him, we will find Him. And I urge you, consider the thought that He has provided the means by which we can find Him through the truths of His Word. That's a conduit right into the reality of God Himself. So, yeah, I'm really glad that Dan Brown wrote the Da Vinci Code. I'm glad that we can have these discussions that are happening all over the world, actually, because of that. because it really does matter what we believe in the final analysis. I'll just leave a bibliography on the overhead if you want to jot down some texts to do some more research on your own. Lord, I find myself thinking about these matters of the history of the Bible and stuff like that, and since on the one hand, you know, it's not what it's all about. It's not about the dry matters of fact of history. It's all about you. It's about knowing you. It's about having something real happening with you. But at the same time, you know, we are aware that we can't know you outside of the realm of what's real and what's true and what happened. And so I thank you for the evidence that you've placed before us, and there's so much more. We've just barely scratched the surface on this topic and so many others. But I would pray, Lord, that you'd give us a hungry mind to not be embarrassed by our faith or in some subtle ways make a disconnect between what we believe to be true and what we rationally think about, but to really bring those worlds together to have a confident faith in you, the confident faith that really informs our lives and gives us the kind of direction that we need. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.